Take a couple of seconds. Technology still scares me, even though... All right, here we go. So again, good morning. My name is Al Hernandez Santana. And I'm glad that I'm first in the order because what I'm going to do is provide you an overview of the topic and of healthcare reform and migrant and other vulnerable populations in context. The required disclosure, so there's nothing to disclose in the past 12 months, so that makes it real easy. And first of all, I wanted to tell you a bit about ourselves and a brief summary of what we do. Because the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California is the leading organized voice for Latinos. We deal in the policies and the conditions that improve the health of our community. And we do that by emphasizing three areas. And you see them there, mainly access to healthcare, disparities in health, and that meaning not just healthcare services, but the health outcomes that we see in our community over time. And then thirdly, community health, or as it's it likes to be known these days as community prevention. And again, looking at the holistic approach to health, the built environment, and how all these planning or economic policies and education policies dovetail to improve the health status of a whole community. And we attack those three areas using a three-prong approach. We are mainly a policy advocacy organization statewide, but we also do research. We have had some publications. And thirdly, increasingly, we're doing more community education through our regional networks and also collaborating in partnership with different organizations. So in order to orient ourselves to the topics that we're going to cover today, I thought I'd just quickly remind you, that's in your synopsis for today, of the learning objectives that we're going to go through. I realized that it would take way too long, so I had to decide to, for example, I'm just going to touch upon the complexities of federal immigration law, and then I'm going to go into the three reasons so that people can sort of bring something back to them. And as well about the different kind of programs or clinics that provide services, even if they're not covered today. Fourthly, again, on this, on as far as the previous efforts to try to cover kids or try to cover immigrant adults or undocumented adults, I'm just going to speak to that off the slide. And if I forget to, I'm just going to, I think, bring one example. You can also ask me in the Q&A. And lastly, I think it's important, given what we are going through today, given the national election and given the economic times, to sort of discuss the political will and the political landscape in order to cover immigrants and what that means to us. You know, this is an increasingly horrendous budget outlook and economic downturn. We just heard from Senator Parada yesterday that the estimated deficit is going to be $10 billion. And if you didn't read the paper yesterday, the governor called an emergency session to deal with the budget November 5th, I believe it is, so right after the national election. So to get started, this is, forgive me for stating the obvious, right? We know that in California, there's a high number of immigrants and uninsured. But just to give you the California numbers, it is estimated the overall immigrant population is about 10 million. Quickly about that, the different estimates as far as the undocumented population varies between 2.7 to 3.1 million in California. And this is, you know, put out by Pew Hispanic Center and the census data. One thing that really, in my mind, was good about the failed comprehensive immigration reform effort, you know, the one that was vetted by Congress when you had the million or over 1 million people march in Los Angeles, that at least everybody sort of agreed as to the number of undocumented in the nation. Because you had the right-wingers and the lefties, you know, arguing, and they all, one inflated the numbers, others not. So we all agreed that it was between 12 million people, and now it's been reduced over the last few years. So as we see people, you know, coming less across the border or not staying as long in the country without papers. So that's about 11 million right now. The budget, of course, the current budget cut many programs that will directly impact immigrants. The only silver lining on that is that the final cuts were not as draconian, you know, they were not as drastic as what was before in the May revision of the budget, for example. But nevertheless, it's really going to hurt the community. The third point there, it should come as no surprise, as I look around the room, the people have been in this in the health field for a while, that most people get their coverage through the employer. And the counties that have the lowest rates of employment-based coverage correspondingly have the highest rates of uninsurance or uninsured folks. So what does that mean that we have all those folks here in the state? It means that the U.S. economy, and in particular the California economy, it's almost, you know, addicted to immigrant labor. As you can see, Mexican immigrant men have a 94% labor participation rate. That's higher than any other group by a big margin in the country. For Mexican immigrant women, we see that the rates are lower. Again, they're raising families or they're coming to join their family here in the States. And one other point is that the low-wage industries, this is where they are more prevalent, the immigrant labor. So therefore meaning that they don't get all these benefits that they that other people do get. Again, the least likely to offer health insurance. And, you know, there's been economic studies or, you know, when the people that are against immigration or against reform, they say, oh, they're taking away all our jobs or they're putting pressure, a downward pressure on wages. The UCLA Health Policy Group has done studies on the issue. I invite you to look them up. And they find that the wage differential is really not there. What they do find is employment-based coverage has really caused an impact because the employer doesn't feel the leverage that or the pressure that they need to offer that benefit if they can just go to somebody who's not here completely, you know, legally. So therefore, the percent of employer-based coverage in California is lower than the rest of the nation. So what does it mean to have all these folks that are out there working every day, and they mainly work, you know, in construction, the service industry, hotel workers, which, by the way, you know, people don't realize that how much damage you can do to your body just cleaning rooms and, you know, lifting those heavy mattresses and straining your back. So you can see here the percent of people, depending on whether they're women, or all women, or Latino men, and so forth, the type of injury for a two-year period. And again, this is all put out by the UC Berkeley Schools of Public Health and the UCLA School. I'm going to move along. So again, just to give you the overall numbers and a big picture of what we're talking about, essentially you see that the number of naturalized citizens here is 30%. Okay, this is also 30%. It's just my program. You know, the numbers didn't add up to 100, so I wanted to make it 100 even. So these over here are legal permanent residents. So those are green card holders, okay? Then we have refugee arrivals and legal temporary residents. And some of these are like temporary protective status. Thank you. You know, if there's a natural disaster in your country, you're allowed to stay here for a while, get a job permit. But let me go on. Essentially, 26% is then undocumented or extra legal. 34.5 million overall immigrants. So what does that mean here in California? Essentially, one way to look at it is that we are all immigrants, not just because of the way this, you know, the United States of America was founded, but because of the composition of our population nowadays. So you see that 1 in 4 is an immigrant, that most of us come from Latin America or Asia. Then about 1 in 11 workers is an undocumented immigrant. I think the previous slides put that in even better perspective. And then we have the complication that, of course, they say, oh, we should all, you know, the right-wingers that we should throw them out. Many of them live in families that are mixed status. And again, the final point here is that immigration has slowed down in the state. And the increase right now is really due to the second generation and new babies being born. You know, it was 10 years ago after, you know, 187 that we already saw a decline in people crossing the border. And then thirdly, which may come as a shock to some folks, is that two-thirds of people in the state favor some form of legalization. We saw that through all of the work that we did in the past 2 years. Trying to move along because it's 15 minutes, right? So over here you see for the people that do have that are eligible, okay, through employment or through a public program, it really, again, this is no surprise to most of you that have done health for any amount of time. Depending on your income, you're more likely to get health insurance. So if you make less than $30,000, only 55% of you are insured. Then once you go up the scale, it's 71%. And just over $50,000 or greater, 89% of folks are insured. So if we're going to deal in public policy, what we need to do is do something else about this 45% over here that has nothing, you know, has no means to get health coverage. And then beyond that, the folks that are immigrants or who are not here, they don't have an undocumented legal status, what can we do about them? So I'm just going to, again, not touch upon federal legislation too much. Just to say that that there's a 5-year ban even on permanent residents, and a lot of people like to forget when they talk about this, when Congress passed it in 1996, that it was was Bill Clinton who signed the act into law. Again, that's what I referred to in the second point. But more recently, the Center for Medicaid Operations came out with an administrative regulation that really cracks down on citizenship verification requirements, which is, scaring a lot of people away. And again, as far as there's a lot of confusion out there, even for those who do qualify, because California has a state option where even though there's a 5-year ban, the state pays state-only funds to cover those folks. There's still confusion out there and fear that they might be declared a public charge, for example. So even though the Clinton administration, before they stepped down, they clarified that rule, the confusion still remains. And there's also sponsor deeming rules that whoever sponsored you to come into the country, their income may also count. So it makes you ineligible because your income is not low enough. So again, there's fear and confusion that prevents people from enrolling in Medicaid or SCHIP. So what do we have then for those folks that don't have a health card or don't have access to a program? What we have is a mishmash of programs, services, and facilities. We have the Family Pack program that deals with reproductive health, sterilization. Again, the mainstream, they're so afraid of all these new babies being born, so they're happy to, okay, let's just try to do family planning here. And then, again, if you are undocumented, you're only eligible for emergency Medi-Cal and prenatal services. One of the key programs that they use is child health, CHDP. Again, because you get your kid to be screened, and then they can be identified for whatever shots they're missing. So that's the vaccine for children that they can go to other clinics, county clinics, and so on. And then we have the medically indigent program that it's so different from county to county. What we have is the County Medi-Cal Services Program and the Medically Indigent Services Program. And I just have to read this off real quick. I'm going to have to go over a minute in my presentation. That some of them do require some documentation as to whether you're here as a citizen or you're a resident of the county. So depending on where you live, that's really going to affect. The 34 CMSP counties require citizenship or legal residency. So undocumented individuals in those counties can only receive 2 months of emergency services. 23 of the MSP counties require county residency only. But 11 of those prohibit undocumented individuals from enrolling. And then finally, if you can't enroll, you know, out of two of those only provide emergency services for undocumented. And they're Tulare and Sacramento County. Sacramento, I'm not so sure about because they had a county board vote, which Senator Deborah Ortiz was instrumental in passing. But essentially, beyond that, we got emergency rooms. I'm going to let Fig, if he chooses to, talk about emergency rooms because we have found the usage is not what we thought it was, 10 years ago. Then you have the public hospitals with their burn units and trauma centers. Again, they're required by law to treat everyone who comes through the door, and then they pawn it off to someone else. But I'm reminded of the fires in San Diego when we had a lot of people crossing the border or who were here undocumented. And then finally, we have the clinics, the 330 federally qualified health centers, or the lookalikes, the free clinics, and other rural health clinics. So essentially, what I wanted to wrap up with is why should we provide insurance coverage? Okay. And I'm just going to try, again, you can sort of unpack many of this and break it down into sub-elements. But as I was brainstorming about this, I wanted to sort of bring out the arguments that people have used in the past or new arguments that we should think about. So essentially, in order to convince the mainstream, you have to use, you know, three or four of these arguments and see what sticks better. But essentially, the fairness... Whoops. Oh, that's too bad. Okay, here we go. Very quickly, the fairness argument. If we have all these people that are here contributing to the economy, okay, they're paying, you know, your taxes or your Social Security into the future, isn't it fair to also give them some form of access to health? We do it through the social contract, I mean, through the, you know, workers' comp. They, undocumented individuals are eligible for workers' comp. And then public health outbreaks, again, this is sort of the avoiding harm concept. Self-interest, again, if people are losing time from work because they have all these injuries and they have no way to get access to healthcare, that's sort of, okay, what's in it for us, right? But then you also have the egalitarian view, which is compassion. You know, this is a very vulnerable population. Legal order, essentially that means it's much like the driver's license argument when we said, well, it's better to know who those folks are instead of just not knowing who's here in the country legally or otherwise. And I think that about covers it. So I think, again, one thing that has worked for us is to talk about a stopgap measure, that the solution is to bring comprehensive reform and pass that. And therefore, there's legal order at that point. And the argument about illegality goes away. But again, it requires a paradigm shift. And I invite people to do their best thinking on the topic. And I'm going to wrap up with that. Thank you so much.
Our next speaker is Howard Kahn.
You're going to wait to applaud till afterwards, right? Good morning. I'm going to do exactly the opposite of what Al did. Al was very organized, very thoughtful. I'm going to be random and jump all over the place. First off, let me give you just a few seconds on the several hats that I wear, and then I'll tell you which one I'll wear for the next few minutes. I am the CEO of LA Care Health Plan, which is a public health plan. I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. I'm also the new chair of the California Association of Health Plans. So I'm a public health plan. Another hat is representing all the health plans in the state of California. I'm also on the Prop 63 Oversight Commission, so I'm starting to look more intensively at issues of mental health and how our funding is going for that. And I'm one of the co-conveners of the Children's Health Initiative. And for those of you from California, there are Children's Health Initiatives throughout California. I'm a co-convener of the one in Los Angeles, which is roughly about half of all the membership in Healthy Kids programs around the state. So I'm going to put on the hat of Howard Kahn. Not in any particular order, but first and foremost, as Howard Kahn, the CEO of LA Care, a public health plan responsible for a lot of Medi-Cal recipients in Los Angeles County. We're supposed to talk about all that we've learned, teach about the healthcare reform. I guess the adage, those that can do and those that can't teach, might apply here because, of course, in California, we couldn't. We couldn't get it done this last time, that's really unfortunate for a lot of reasons. I'll tell you why it was particularly unfortunate from our perspective in Los Angeles is that we have a very high number of uninsured, of course. We had created, with the support of First Five and the California Endowment and Blue Shield Foundation and LA Cares Board, and a lot of other organizations, a coalition to insure uninsured kids. We enrolled 45,000 kids, not covered by any state program, in the first 12 months. That we were something we were supposed to do over 3 years. So we had a massive number of kids insured in Los Angeles County, and we had to stop it. We had to shut it at 45,000, and the kids, the enrollments were not slowing up at that point. We had counted on, and the governor had included in his proposal, covering all the kids in California. So we had counted on being able to provide coverage to not just the kids in our Healthy Kids program from LA Care and all of our partners, but also to be able to insure the rest of the kids. So we are, in the Children's Health Initiatives, in a sense, the example of what happens when you fail to change things. Because those kids are at risk of losing coverage now. We've been able to patch it together for a little bit of time, but this is the one group that very specifically would lose something by healthcare reform not going through potentially, as opposed to folks who don't have it now and aren't going to be able to get it. As I say, we've been able to keep the program going for about another 9 months or so through a variety of funding sources, but it's a real problem going forward. Over three quarters of the kids in our program are undocumented, getting to Al's issue, and all of our issue, really. Over three quarters of the kids in those programs are from families with at least one full-time working adult, also something that Al was pointing out before. So these are very different than the stereotype of the folks that are on my big program, Medi-Cal, which is families who aren't working, who don't have an income, et cetera. These are from largely intact families with two parents who are working and the kids are in school. And we've said that it's okay to provide them with an education, even though they're undocumented. We just can't make them healthy, is sort of where we've been thus far. So that's particularly unfortunate from our perspective. What I'm supposed to talk to specifically is, what about these Medi-Cal managed care programs, Medicaid managed care programs outside of California? Is anybody here not from California? Let me just see. Okay, you can't stay. No. What state are you from? Okay, you're from D.C., so you're not from a state.
I live in Virginia, though.
Okay, well, I'm going to talk in California talk, but you'll get it. It's not very different. Medi-Cal has moved to managed care over the past 10 years in particular. Actually, over the last 20 years, because there are a few programs, like in San Mateo and Santa Barbara, that have been around for 20 years, but really in the last 10 years, moved in a big way to managed care. That has generally worked very well for the state of California. It's worked because it's contained cost. It's worked because it has helped improve access to care, although you hear anecdotal complaints when you look at the statistics. It's really worked. And, for example, LA Care, the plan that I run, which has 750,000 members enrolled in it, so it's a pretty good-sized health plan, just received NCQA accreditation at the excellent level, the highest level. You didn't have that in Medi-Cal fee-for-service. In fact, there's no regulation at all in the Medi-Cal fee-for-service system. No offense to the state of California, but generally speaking, if you're not convicted of something, you can be a Medi-Cal provider. I mean, it really is tough to get kicked out of the Medi-Cal program. And so managed care has really accomplished something, I would argue. As we look toward expanding coverage, and hopefully we'll be looking at that issue in another week, nationally at least, What we have to do is think about, well, how do we do it? Do we do it purely through the private insurance and have subsidies, et cetera? Do we do it through expansion of the current public programs or not? I would argue that expansion of the public programs is one of the vehicles that should be used, particularly for low-income folks, not to go and compete for those that can afford to get private health care insurance, but for those who are going to need to be subsidized. The public programs that we have in California are invaluable tool in that process for several reasons. One, Medi-Cal managed care programs are used to working with folks at the lower income levels and all of the issues that they face. A critical point. Secondly, Medi-Cal managed care or Medicaid managed care programs are accustomed to working with government. And working with government is not necessarily easy. Now, I say that as a public agency, so I am government in some sense at LA Care. But it's not easy, and there's an art form to it. And having spent a couple of years on the private side at Aetna and Cigna, I can tell you that working with government is an art form that has to be learned. And I think the Medi-Cal managed care programs have learned that very well over time. I'm going to, as I said, I promise, I'm going to skip around a little bit. I'm going to move just briefly to healthcare reform and why LA Care was supportive of what the governor was trying to accomplish and what the speaker was trying to accomplish here in California. For a number of reasons, and let me say that, and Figg will disagree with me on this, I don't think we really were looking at healthcare reform. I think we were mostly looking at healthcare expansion because I think of it as sort of a three-legged stool, that we've got the issues that we face in the U.S. of access / coverage, quality, and cost. I don't think we had any grand solutions for dealing with cost and quality in those reform proposals, although there was some attempt to do that. I think what we were doing was trying to solve one of the three issues, which would be tremendous because then you reduce the debate and the discussion down and you focus it onto what I would consider to be the two remaining critical issues of quality and cost. Without that, what we have is people having three separate conversations all the time in the United States, because some of us are very concerned about coverage, others are concerned about cost, others are concerned about quality, and we end up talking past one another. So we were supportive because we thought that it would do a lot to address the issue of coverage and also the issues of cross subsidies right now from the private side to the public side, because Medi-Cal is the best healthcare deal in America. It really is right now. And when I say that, I don't say that, and thus we should continue it as it is. But the state of California and the federal government get off more cheaply in the Medi-Cal program than any other public program in the U.S. or private program. We just pay a lot less, which means the private side has to cross-subsidize, which means fewer people will have private coverage because it's becoming more and more expensive for the employers or for individuals who are paying for it. That said, I thought that what the governor was doing, what the speaker was doing with him, what the Senate was sort of half doing depending on the day, was a tremendous potential progress for the state of California. What I want to do is jump back again for a moment now to the effect of healthcare reform on the safety net potentially, because I think that's very important right now. And I'm going to talk about Los Angeles, and it is 35% of the state's population, I guess, roughly. When you look at Los Angeles, we have a safety net that's composed of, again, three legs in a sense. You have public hospitals, you have private hospitals, and then you have the safety net clinics, the clinics that Al was talking about before. I would argue that safety net clinics, by and large, and we've done a lot to support them at LA Care, have been pretty well funded and supported and have grown regardless of the administration. The Bush administration loved them because that way they didn't have to cover people. So they just more clinics. So everybody kept giving more and more money to the clinics. That doesn't mean they're in great long-term financial state. That just means that right now they're in pretty good shape and they've been growing and there are a lot more of them and they provide great primary care. The public hospitals, and one can be critical of Los Angeles County, Lord knows the LA Times is, but in fact LA County offers the biggest safety net, public safety net in the country. With an amazing number of services being provided. It's forever challenged. But I think the most immediate threat in Los Angeles is actually the private hospitals that serve low-income people. They're the ones that are having problems with keeping their emergency rooms open, not because people who don't have insurance abuse the system, because actually they use it at a lower rate, the emergency rooms, but they do need those services, and they don't have reimbursement. And the real problem is not reimbursement. The ERs are crowded not because of poor people, not because of uninsured people. They're crowded because primary care doctors for insured people send their patients there all the time. I mean, to a large extent, I think that's really true. But what I think is really important is that those private safety net hospitals will be shutting down in greater and greater numbers if we don't do something about coverage, because they can't afford to continue providing services and not be paid for them over time. So one of the reasons why I believe that managed care and the public programs will be so important when we start to move toward healthcare reform is that when you move to healthcare reform and you expand coverage, you have to have some sensitivity to the needs of the safety net and to the needs of the patients that are being newly served under an insurance form. So my final point is just that not only do I think that managed care and health plans can serve a very important function as we move toward expanding care and healthcare reform, I would argue that public plans in particular, and there are a number of them throughout California. Someone's here from San Mateo County. The health plan of San Mateo has been operating for 20 years. LA Care in San Francisco, Alameda, Santa Barbara, in about 15 counties now, I think it is, maybe 20 counties, throughout California, there are public plans, many times competing with the private plans. And I would argue that that's a pretty healthy competition that goes on. But the public plans are particularly concerned about supporting the safety net, expanding coverage, working with the clinics in the community, because they are that's part of their mission, and because they are stakeholder-driven and governed. That is, on my board, for example, I have the hospitals represented, I have the community clinics represented, I have the county board of supervisors represented, I have elected consumer members elected by my members, that is, by Medi-Cal recipients, who elect a couple of representatives to our board. You just don't find that on the private side. And so this healthy competition tension between the public and private side, I think, provides a valuable contribution as we look toward expansion. And so I think that really as we watch, because we're not going to have a single-payer system. I know that's not a popular thing to say at an APHA meeting. We're not going to have a single-payer system, okay? The U.S. is not going to go in that direction unless we have the biggest crisis you've ever seen, because that's what the body politic is about. So I think where we'll be moving is to one of these kinds of competitive systems. I'm not talking about what I necessarily want or think will be right. I'm talking about what I think is an inevitability, and the U.S. doesn't like radical change from what it's, you know, as a people, we just don't. So with that in mind, I think that's where we're going to end up, is in some sort of competitive system. And I would argue you want public agencies, private agencies competing within that system. Let me stop there and let the next speaker contradict everything I just said. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, our next speaker is Richard Thompson.
Okay, thank you. Let's see if I can figure this out.